Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming's arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant content in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at the risk for consumer internet stocks as cost cuts and inflation just take their toll.
Plus, rail volumes look to post growth in the coming year.
But first, the ability of luxury good makers to drive double-digit sales in 2023 is partially reliant on China. So what do you do with that when there's still so much uncertainty around China? We're joined now by Bloomberg Intelligence senior luxury goods analyst Deborah Aiken. Deborah, just to start off, what kind of stocks are we talking about? How have they already performed?
So we're looking at companies like LVMH, Kering, Hermes, Richemont, a whole range of stocks across the luxury space. They're down 22% year to date.
So, Deb, I know from talking to you in the past and reading your research that China really is a key driver for luxury goods sales, both in China itself and then just around the world as the Chinese tourism grows. Boy, I'm not sure I got confidence in anything China reopening here. How do you think about it?
So if we go back to 2019, if we go back to those numbers, we saw China as a buyer inland and traveling internationally, free to travel. They were making up near a third of the luxury market. That repatriated back to China when we had closures. And we think we've lost around 15% of the market in China. So we think that China now accounts for around 15 to 20% of the luxury market, with them buying inland, with Chinese purchasing in the mainland. There are a good representation of stores there from the biggest brands, and also online is huge in China with big JVs and others. So that's where we are. In terms of where we are and what they're doing, over in China, we've seen the 20-point plan. There's really a push for more reopening when stores do reopen. As we saw through June and July, we had double-digit growth and then closures again and reticence to go back to stores when there's so much tracking taking place.
Well, I guess I wonder a couple of things. But first, the idea that all of a sudden China's going to reopen and they're all just going to go buy luxury stuff, I wonder if the last 3 years, though, have been really scarring. Just because we reopen one day doesn't mean that all of a sudden President Xi won't close it the next day. So I'm just wondering sort of how predictable you think you can count on the Chinese consumer.
When stores are open, we're getting double-digit growth. When product is able to move around, because it's also a supply chain issue, if a particular city is closed, when it opens, we're getting double-digit growth.
So it's there. Like, it's definitely happening.
Right, it's happening when open. You know, there's a huge amount of internet correlation from social media sites, from online purchasing, from interest in online events, pop-ups, others, and so much money being pushed globally from these companies into China for when the reopening takes place. But you're absolutely right. We can't take anything for granted, be it more cases of COVID as well, more lockdowns to come. But luxury companies have proved themselves truly, truly transient in the way that they've been so flexible in managing demand where it is globally. We saw that a lot in Europe this year because of weakness of the euro and big US invention and shopping in Europe from the US consumer.
So, Deb, talk to us about the margins for some of these luxury companies. I know a lot of companies dealing with supply chain issues and just cost issues in general, inflation. How's that affect the luxury brands?
Yeah, so if I give you these numbers, for 2022, we're expecting to come out of 2022 with a 12% top-line growth and 20% EPS growth. And in the middle of that is where the operational leverage is. So you're looking at around 18% operating profit growth. Margins range for these companies 20 to high 30%. And actually, overall, we're seeing margins slightly higher versus last year. How are they achieving that? So they have a relatively low cost base, a very long-term trend in the way that they have long-term commitment and hedging on the purchases of leathers. And generally, we know that these companies are producing out of France, Italy, parts of Southern Europe. So they've always had to deal with supply chain, and they've become even more frugal and efficient at it over the last couple of years.
What kind of reopening and sales is already priced into these guys?
I think when I look at the fact that the markets, you know, that the sector is down 22% year to date, and the fact that if I look at a PE of around 23 times, which, by the way, is starting to go up a little bit on the question of whether there'll be more reopenings and some relaxation, I still think we're looking at around a 20% discount. And that comes through partly on China, but also on travel. So there are key brands out there that I think can really benefit. But that's where we are. We're probably operating at around 80% of the market right now.
Do these companies, by and large, have a outsized exposure to Russia and kind of what's going on in that part of the world?
Yeah, so, you know, when this all broke in Feb, we looked at that, and actually it's around 1% to 3%. The biggest exposure was Farfetch, the e-marketplace, at 6% to 7%, doing everything for companies who didn't have stores there. But overall, actually, Q1 will become an easier quarter in a way, because there'll be that high comp from last year, where then through Q2 and Q3, some of these companies and brands exited the country. But overall, you know, we're just looking for gradual improvement as we get it. And otherwise, still underlying at the very high end, US is very strong. Russia, the amount of money we actually spent in Russia was very small compared to Russian shopping elsewhere. And we've not heard any companies really come through in Q2 or Q3 into the end of year to say that Russia's been a big drag.
Deborah, thanks so much. I really appreciate Deborah Aiken, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Luxury Goods Analyst.
Coming up on the program, we'll see how small caps are faring.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Alex, I'm getting bullish here. Here's my call here on equities.
Ooh, okay.
I think I've seen peak inflation. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel in terms of rate increases. Maybe I got a little more earnings risk out there, but I'm close. So I'm ready to go here. I think 2023 is going to be a good year. I guess my question is, in the stock market, how to play it? Fortunately, we have professionals that can help us with that. Gina Martin Adams, she's a U.S. equity strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. Do you share my overall call? And if you do, how should I kind of think about getting into this market?
Let's split those in two questions.
Okay.
On the first question, I am increasingly confident that the bottom has likely been made, or at least we entered a bottoming process. And we've been talking about that since October with sort of the crash that we experienced in the S&P 500 in September and October, getting as ugly as it did. We clearly created some form of a sentiment low, which is usually what the precursor to a much better market outcome going forward. So I can share some of your optimism. Now, the degree of optimism, we can probably argue about a lot, right?
So what is your degree?
It Paul's fairly like super limited at this point because we've had such a nice rally already. We've priced in a lot of that recovery that we do also think is going to emerge in 2023. Now, I think you can make a much stronger case for different sector and factor strategies, though, performing quite well into 2023. And I do think it will be a market where maybe your absolute returns are in the single digit possibilities. But if you pick the right sector stocks and industries and you're a factor investor, you probably could do quite well. So we're leaning into cyclicals, financials, industrials pop to the top of our scorecard this quarter, which is very rare. All year, our scorecard has been energy
and
defensive
sectors. And you literally
have a
scorecard. I'm looking at it right here. There's green and yellow and red. So even guys like me can figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. So we relative rank all of the 11 sectors, and those value-centric cyclical sectors are now at the top, which sends a pretty positive signal. Now, on the other end, if you're a tech or healthcare investor, those are at the bottom of our scorecard still. So some of those growthy stocks, the higher quality stocks, if you will, that really led the last cycle's returns into the pandemic, we think are going to continue to lag over the course of 2023.
I feel like what we've seen recently in this last month is the outperformance of Europe over U.S.
Uh-huh.
And there seems to be a real debate emerging as to whether you can still put money into the U.S. or if you should be putting it into Europe. If we're borrowing some of the growth from 2023 in an equity rally, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I sympathize with the idea that non-U.S. stocks will most likely lead. If we're moving into what we think is a cyclical recovery over the course of 2023, we finally do find our bottom. We finally do get plenty of cost cuts to create that margin low. We get a little bit of relief on the dollar pressure. It would support non-domestic over domestic securities.
Does non-domestic mean Europe, or does non-domestic mean
it's probably
Asia?
EM a little bit more than it is Europe, just because valuations are so suppressed in EM and they do tend to be a little bit more dollar sensitive. It's more risk on. And you've seen just tremendous valuation compression. But all of it, frankly, Europe is extremely cheap relative to the US as well. There's just more earnings risk still in the European market. Our European strategist is pretty bearish on European earnings growth prospects still relative to consensus. So that could be the chief impediment there.
How about in terms of size here? Large cap growth has been kind of what we've all lived on over the last decade plus. So am I thinking maybe something different here? Small cap value, or how do you think that the market can?
I think that small caps do present a tremendous opportunity. Small caps are just struggling for that catalyst, kind of like large caps are. Normally, at this point in the cycle, you get a Fed reversal, and that Fed reversal is what sort of ignites the fire in equity markets. Mm-hmm. My outlook for 2023, by no coincidence, is no spark, no fire.
Okay.
So well, how are you going to get that spark, that, you know, the fire without the spark of the Fed is a huge question mark. And small caps usually benefit the most from that reduction in interest rates because they're heavy borrowers. That said, small caps have already been in a massive bear market for going on 2 years, and they're incredibly discounted relative to the S&P 500. They're also lower duration, as you point out. You don't have the risk of the high growth, still expensive techs and healthcares to the degree that you do in large caps. So there do appear to be a lot of opportunities in small caps, but they do suffer from that same overwhelming sort of macro malaise, I think, of lacking that spark.
What's the earning risk downside potential to small caps? Like talking about just they've been beaten up so much and valuations, that feels like a Europe thing too. But Europe, there's the earnings risk. Do small caps have the same earnings risk if we get into recession?
Potentially not. It depends on the degree of recession. So we're talking about two different economies, right? And I do think that the recession risk, the potential for a deeper recession in Europe is probably more than a deeper recession in the United States. That said, we could probably argue a lot about, you know, the recession risk here in the United States is still awfully high. On small caps, when we do valuation work for small caps, we actually do valuations based on revenue growth. And revenue growth for small caps is still a detractor from performance. But going into 2023, later 2023, revenue growth should bounce back faster than the S&P 500. So that's how we're thinking about the sequence for small caps.
You know, I think back to the last earnings cycle, companies like Caterpillar, they had some good numbers. Industrial companies had some pretty good numbers. I think about the stocks Karen Eberhardt covers, you know, the industrials, the ags. How do they kind of score for you?
Yeah, industrials score very high on our scorecard. There are three sectors that very typically lead recoveries out of recession lows, and those are financials, industrials, and consumer discretionary. The only group that is not in our top segments of our scorecard is consumer discretionary, and much of that is because consumer discretionary is still weighed down by the exposure that they have to Tesla and Amazon, which are two very, very expensive, very techy, very growthy oriented stocks. But the rest of the sector actually screens pretty well. In industrials, you know, we've already started to see industrials perform very well. Mm-hmm. Every single industry group within industrials posted a positive return in the month of November. Yep. We've started to see rotation start to benefit this group pretty tremendously. In similar fashion, financials does tend to perform very well in the early stages of recovery once we get that yield curve reaching its maximum depth. So the scorecard is hinting that you do want to start to move toward some of these early cyclical groups. Definitely industrials is one of those.
Is there going to be a tale of two cities here in 2023? Like, is the first half going to be bad and the second half better, or vice versa? Like, is it going to be a kind of binary year?
It seems like that for earnings. Will it be that way for price is really anybody's guess. Considering how robust the market has been here in October and November, I think that we're due for a little bit of a pullback come December with tax loss selling. That can extend into January, and we could be due for a very, very weak market. But we'll see.
Great stuff. Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Equity Strategist Gina Martin Adams.
All right, coming up, we're going to delve into the internet sector. What's in store for next year?
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts, covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
So in case you haven't heard, we're looking at a growing risk of recession for 2023 and worries about a pullback in discretionary spending. So what does this wind up meaning for the internet sector for next year? We're joined now by Bloomberg Intelligence senior technology analyst Mandeep Singh. When we say internet sector, what are we talking about specifically?
Yeah, so look, there are a lot of consumer internet companies with different kinds of business models. You've got ad-based companies, you've got marketplace companies, and then you've got e-commerce companies. These are the three broad buckets. And the drivers for all of these companies are different, right? So if ad spending is pulling back because of a recession fear and, you know, companies curtailing their marketing spending, that will have a bearing early on in the cycles simply because that's discretionary. Compared to, you know, marketplace spending, you could argue you still are going around, you would take an Uber, and, you know, you're not going to cut back that quickly. And e-commerce, mm-hmm. we know there was a pull forward during the pandemic, but now Black Friday sales were pretty good. So people are still shopping online. That habit isn't going to change. So there are different drivers, and that's how we are framing 2023 outlook.
All right. So in a recession, I know from my experience covering media companies that, boy, that advertising spend is a discretionary spend, as you mentioned, can be cut very quickly. So that's a challenge for, I guess, the Facebooks of the world. But don't they still have the secular winds at their back, which is more and more people are spending more and more time online, therefore more and more ad dollars will flow there?
Yeah, so a couple of things to call out there. One is their exposures vary. Google is a lot more diversified in terms of their advertiser exposure, whereas Meta is more SMB focused. So
small and mid-sized businesses,
right now, that's where we are seeing the most weakness. That is where there is a big pullback in spending. And in the case of Alphabet, look, search spending will hold up fairly better simply because they were less affected by IDFA changes, Apple's privacy changes. That hurt Meta, Snapchat, the direct response app players a lot more. And so that will continue. The other big factor to call out is you've got a lot of new entrants in this space, like Netflix, like Disney. They're offering an ad tier. And they're offering an ad tier where the ad loads aren't very high. They're focused on ad pricing. So they're trying to get that premium ad pricing band, which is really with Alphabet and to an extent with Meta. Because of the low ad loads, advertisers could gravitate towards that platform.
Oh, that's interesting. So basically, there's more players looking after a deteriorating ad pie because of demand concerns and because of recession concerns.
Yeah, and look at how big Amazon has become. It used to be a duopoly, Alphabet and Meta. Now you have got Amazon, a formidable number three, And I'm thinking we could probably have Netflix and Disney join the ranks. Look, it's going to take a while for them to ramp up, but clearly the trend is towards more fragmentation in the ad market.
All right, you mentioned Meta. I got to go there. I mean, if I'm an investor, I don't know what to do here. I mean, I got a business that's slowing, as you mentioned, the core advertising business. And then I got a CEO who says he's going to spend a gajillion and one dollars on this thing. I don't even know what it is, this metaverse thing. That's not a recipe for a good stock price performance, is it?
It's not. And look, I think he's thinking too far ahead in terms of what could be the next leg of growth for a company of Meta size, $120 billion in revenue run rate.
Wow.
How do you drive growth going forward? The question is, if the fundamental business, the core business, deteriorates to a point where you are having negative growth for the next couple of years, that's going to scare a lot of investors, and then you can never come back from that sort of slide. So I think that is where...
Hasn't anybody told Zuckerberg this?
Well, so that's why they're doing the cost cuts, right?
Okay,
so the OPEX cuts are really meant to kind of focus on, okay, look, we have a problem, revenue problem. We need to rein in the costs, and they're trying to do that.
But to that point, all of tech seems to be cutting costs and either laying off people or doing hiring freezes. Like, is that going to be enough to offset the slump in ad revenue?
Which brings me to the point about estimate cuts. We've seen pretty decent estimate cuts in the second half this year, you know, about 10 to 20% top line, 25 to 30% bottom line for next year. My thinking is there is more to come here, simply because the top line headwinds are getting more pronounced in the near term with, you know, recession talks and everything. And we're not thinking about a rebound right now or, you know, a comeback anytime soon. So it will probably get worse before it gets better. And what that means is companies with high fixed costs, which all of these companies do have, will have to go through this cost rationalization, which they're trying to do with, you know, 12 to 15% job cuts.
Mandeep, always a pleasure. We could talk to you forever. I'm Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst.
All right, coming up on the program, we'll discuss the outlook for U.S. regional banks in the coming year.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Regional banks had pretty strong earnings momentum. What happens in 2023 if we head into some kind of recession? So let's get the word on that with Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Banks Analyst Herman Chan. So Herman, what's your prediction for 2023 when it comes to the regional guys and how exposed they're going to be to rates and the economy?
Sure. So for regional banks, it's been a tale of two cities so far for 2022. We've had really strong earnings momentum with interest rates rising, thereby lifting net interest margins. Loan growth has really accelerated from the depths of the pandemic. So you've had strong earnings power, but the valuations have been weakened because of the threat of a potential recession. For 2023, we expect some loan growth to start to dissipate as higher prices and slower economic activity really, you know, weakens the outlook for lending and loan originations. And net interest margins are actually expected to peak later on in 2023 because of the fact that the Fed will at some point pause with their rising interest rate posture. On the other hand, because of a potential recession looming, the wild card will be how banks react to rising loan losses, which we expect to drive bad debt provisioning for 2023. So weaker earnings potential for next year is definitely our view.
One of my issues when I look at regional banks is kind of loan origination. I think of these as institutions that are obviously loaning out to small and mid-sized businesses, and they're really reflective of an economic backdrop. Give us a sense of how loan origination is today in terms of growth, loan growth, and maybe what you're looking for next year.
Sure. So loan growth for the regionals has been particularly strong because they're more focused on, as you mentioned, the small, medium-sized businesses. So commercial lending has been really solid across the industry. It's been up about 10% year-to-date. And that's really driven by higher loan volumes, loan utilizations of existing credit lines. And also some of the issues that happened during the pandemic with supply chain issues, those have receded. So, for example, car dealerships have more inventory on their lots, so they will borrow more from their banks, which helps loan growth for the regionals.
As we look into next year, a lot of credit investors are like getting really pumped for defaults. They're like ready. They're like ready for distressed credit and stuff. What kind of default cycle do you think the regional guys are going to have to contend with?
Sure. So the base expectation is it's going to be a shallow recession, but consensus is already baking in bad debt provisions 2-3 times levels prior to the pandemic. So we're looking at 2019 levels, and 2023 could be provisioning could be twice to three times as much as you saw at that period.
Talk to us about the profit margins of these regional banks. Kind of what are the key drivers you look at, and kind of where are we, and how's that going to play out?
Sure. So we look at net interest margins, which is the key driver of profitability for regional banks. And that's really driven by, on the asset side, two things. The level of interest rates. So rates are rising, and you've seen banks really capitalize because the loan yields that they're gaining from their assets is much higher than it was a year ago. Another thing that I mentioned earlier is loan growth. So higher loan balances helps profitability. And what's really interesting is that banks continue to lag on the deposit pricing side. So the pass-through of deposit costs that they give to their deposit customers has lagged, and we calculate about a 20% pass-through from the interest rate hikes from the Fed this year. So that eventually will catch up to the banks next year as banks pay more and more for their deposits, as deposits continue to exit the system. They'll pay more to keep those deposits on the balance sheet. So that should infer some weaker net interest margins later on in the back half of next year.
What bank do you think is going to perform the best next year?
We like banks that have really strong deposit franchises. Mm-hmm. So I had mentioned earlier that the industry is seeing some deposit attrition because of quantitative tightening, I should say. And also customers, both commercial and consumer customers, are spending more because of rising inflation. So all that deposits are starting to exit out of the system. So banks that are able to retain deposits, and especially lower cost deposits, banks like Regions and M&T here in the Northeast, Regions in the Southeast, have traditionally strong deposit franchises, which could help them sustain that net interest margin expansion that we've been talking about.
All right, Herman, thanks a lot. Herman Chan, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Banks Analyst. Thank you very much.
All right, let's turn now to North American Railroads, whose volume growth looks poised to post feeble gains in 2023. We're joined now by Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Transportation and Logistics Analyst Lee Klaskow. So, Lee, the railroads, if we go into a recession, how should we think about kind of rail freight, rail traffic?
Yeah, so expectations right now are pretty low for volume growth. And obviously for the rail industry, volume growth is pretty important given the robust incremental margins that they can generate for a fixed asset network like railroads. So going into 2023, with a recession, which, is probably a 60% probability according to economists surveyed by Bloomberg, there's a pretty good chance that, there's going to be negative economic growth. So that's obviously not good for the rails. There's, you know, going to be some pockets of strength. Grain is expected to be really good, not only in the fourth quarter of this year, but into next year. That's driven by some really good easy comps for Canadian grain, coupled with the fact that it's going to be a robust harvest this year. And then you know, the automotive comparisons are pretty easy versus last year, as the automotive industry supply chains are kind of fixing themselves and they can ramp up production and get cars off the assembly lines. And that's going to be, you know, mitigated by weakness in coal, which we expect after 2 years of growth will start returning to their secular long-term decline.
So going back to the supply chain issues for a second, has those issues been totally cleared for the rails? Is this like a clean slate where we can just kind of focus on growth now and underlying demand?
No, we're not at a total clean slate. I mean, the rail industry, what they did at, the second quarter of 2020 during the pandemic is they probably over furloughed their workers. And then when demand snapped back, they found themselves in the same situation that a lot of other employers found themselves in. They couldn't get enough people back to work. And so what they've been doing since then is really going out there and hiring and training people. They've done a great job, I would say, properly resourcing their networks, but they still have a ways to go. And once they do that, you know, you're going to see productivity improvements, service improvements, and network fluidity improvements, which also, you know, should translate into better margins for the rail industry. But those better margins probably are not going to come until 2024, just given the fact that, you know, the kind of muted volume outlook that we talked about earlier. They do get pricing. They do have pricing power. At the end of the day, it's a very consolidated market, and so they do have that pricing power to kind of offset the inflationary expenses that they're facing. But it's going to be pretty tough for that to go down to the bottom line. And also, they're going to lose some revenue that they got for accessorial fees, where they, you know, charge shippers, money if they left equipment in the yards for too long. Because general supply chains are improving, you know, they're not going to have that revenue stream as more carloads are kind of traveling more fluid through the network.
What rail company do you think is best positioned to weather all of this uncertainty?
Well, I think the most interesting one, and again, we don't do buy, hold, sell recommendations, but I think the most interesting one over the next 12 months is going to be Canadian Pacific. You know, they're about to close on their acquisition of Kansas City Southern, and that's actually going to provide them with a lot of revenue opportunities because they're going to be a lot more competitive with some of their peers on lanes that they'll be going up against with Canadian National and Union Pacific. And that network, once the regulators approve it, which again, we expect in the first quarter, you know, will really create an interesting NAFTA network connecting Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And that's just going to open up a host of opportunities. And, you know, in our view, Canadian Pacific has always been a better operator than Kansas City Southern. And some of those best practices put onto their network will really drive margin improvement for that legacy Kansas City Southern business that they're buying. So I think that's the most interesting railroad over the next 12 months.
Just real quickly, give us the competitive landscape with the truckers right now, the rails. Do compete against truckers.
Yeah, and listen, they are always fighting for share. The rails really missed an opportunity because of the service issues that we discussed about earlier. Because last year, the trucking capacity markets were extremely tight and rates were very high, making rails more attractive. But, you know, spot rates have come down considerably. You know, they're getting close to pre-pandemic levels. And the rails are just getting back to improving their overall service to be more competitive with trucking. You are always going to see give and take between the two. From a secular standpoint, you know, it's always been our take that it is a growth story where they should get more freight off the roads onto the rails, just given, you know, their lower carbon footprint and the fact that, you know, ESG is becoming more important to shippers and to investors as well.
Lee, thanks a lot. Always a pleasure, Lee Klasko. Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior Transportation and Logistics Analyst.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.